Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Marcus Gehring. I'm a fellow of the Lauterbach Center. And on behalf of the director, Sandy, here in front, warmest welcome to the Friday lunchtime lecture, also the audience online. Our speaker today, and I should highlight that the lunchtime lecture series is sponsored by Cambridge University Press. Not to forget that. Our speaker today needs no introduction in Cambridge. He's a long-term friend and was a fellow from 2008 to 2019 in the Lauterbach Center. Professor Michael Weibel from the University of Vienna is a professor of international law, and his teaching and writing focuses on international economic law, sovereign debt, international dispute settlement. He won the Deak Prize of ASIL and the Book Prize of the European Society of International Law, as well as a Leverhulme Prize for his research. And he's the co-editor of the ICSID reports with Jorge Vinmales and the co-editor-in-chief of the leading journal in the field, the Journal of International Economic Law. As a former fellow and director of studies of Jesus College, he's very well known to all of us. And we are always delighted when he's back. He has degrees in law and in economics and has worked at the World Bank as an economist, as well as the European Central Bank and the International Monetary Fund. So he's superbly placed to reimagine the international monetary and financial law. Michael, you have the floor.
Thank you so much, Marcus, for this very generous and introduction and the welcome back to the center. It's a true pleasure to be back at the Lauterbach Center, and I thank the director and the deputy director for the kind invitation, especially since this room has expanded quite considerably since my time here. Reimagining international monetary and financial law. As we all know, as international lawyers, the time just after World War II was a moment of frantic innovation. We have international organizations of unprecedented authority, ambitious multilateral treaties that popped up like mushroom, effective collective security was seemingly on the table, human rights were starting to be taken seriously, and even the international control of atomic energy seemed at that time a possibility. A golden age of and for international law seemed to beckon. In international monetary affairs, John Maynard Keynes, the famous economist at King's College, Cambridge, was central to reimagining the international monetary system, primarily by establishing the IMF already in 1944, before the end of the war. And that is the International Monetary Fund, of course, not Tom Cruise's impossible mission. So sometimes it may seem like the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, tries to do the impossible. My talk this afternoon has two parts. I will first trace the over and underestimation of international law in this particular field of international monetary and financial law, how this pendulum has swung over the last 85 years or so. And then looking briefly ahead, where might we be going and how could we reimagine international monetary and financial law? Thinking about the United Nations soon after it was founded, the Austrian-American international lawyer Joseph Kuntz, writing in the American Journal in 1950, was concerned, expressed concern that the new United Nations was underestimating international law. And he anticipated that over time, this deficit would be reversed, that international law would come to play a greater role in the United Nations. And he said that swings of the pendulum when it comes to the role of international law are particularly great in periods of fundamental crisis like our present epoch. And that, of course, could also be said to apply where we find ourselves today. So moving to the swings of the pendulum in international monetary and financial law. As economic historians have documented extensively, we had already, from around 1870 onwards, a first wave of globalization with high degrees of economic integration, trade, investment, and capital flows that bear some eerie resemblance to what we have had in the last 30 to 40 years. The international monetary order that underpinned a lot of this international economic exchange in the late 19th century rested on informal cooperation, particularly between central banks, rather than international monetary obligations. And the key example of it was the gold standard to which key countries adhered. It made international payments more or less automatic. And if we had law that dealt with money at the time, it was private international law rather than public international. This system of informal cooperation, coupled with the stability that resulted for several decades from Great Britain's monetary hegemony, abruptly ended and led to a first swing of the pendulum with the First World War, which destroyed the international monetary order as it had existed in 1913. The gold standard was abrogated, currencies swung wildly, capital controls were introduced everywhere, and the system for international payments fractured. National treasuries, exhausted from World War I, were depleted, and we had unsustainable public debt levels that cast a long and painful shadow over post-war economic recovery. Now, faced with these major challenges, central banks struggled to cooperate informally as they had done prior to 1914. And by the 1930s, the international monetary cooperation that we had that had been there before had entirely collapsed. And here enter Keynes and his US counterpart, Harry Dexter White. They realized during World War II that international monetary cooperation needed to be put on an entirely new footing. Together, these two economists and policymakers were the chief architects of the IMF. They concluded that one couldn't build in this area on what the League of Nations had done with a broad mandate in economic and financial matters, because that was essentially a non-order that didn't work. It was essential for there to be robust multilateralism. But multilateralism, of course, that was largely shaped by the United States and the United Kingdom. So they convened states in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, and after longish negotiations, we have a second swing of the pendulum in international monetary affairs with the drafting of the IMF Articles of Agreement that, among other things, established a system of fixed exchange rates and included several important international monetary obligations. All currencies pegged to the US dollar, which became the new anchor currency. And the dollar, in turn, was backed at $35 per ounce with gold. This new international monetary order was underpinned by treaty obligations. And that was a sharp departure from what we had in the interwar period. Joseph Gold, the British and most influential general counsel of the IMF, called it an unprecedented system for regulating exchange rates under a multilateral treaty administered by an international organization. And after this effort by policymakers to come up with a new international monetary order, the IMF, at least for the next three decades, became a highly influential international organization, partly because it was given a lot of latitude how to go about administering, guarding this new international monetary order from 1945 until 1971, when this international monetary order collapsed, or was collapsed, as I explained in a few minutes, almost overnight. When it comes to exchange rates, the IMF in this three-decade period had strict rules, and states generally complied. Finance ministries and central banks were committed to exchanging domestic currency for foreign currency at the established fixed exchange rate, the so-called par values. Central banks regularly intervened in foreign exchange markets to make sure that these pegs, exchange rate pegs, were maintained. The IMF rarely authorized changes in these exchange rates, and there was very little room for currency manipulation, which has become a major issue in the last two decades. And through this system of fixed exchange rates and the discipline that it brought with it, the Bretton Woods system in these first three decades of its existence managed to largely internalize the externalities that arise from monetary policy. And that is in some contrast to what we have today, where we have a few important central banks that set central banks primarily with the domestic economy in mind. I'm thinking here, of course, of the US Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of China, with very little regard for the externalities that these monetary policy decisions have beyond their borders. For example, for highly indebted developing countries, which has once again become a major policy issue as a result of the expenditure incurred during the pandemic, among others. To ensure that this new international monetary order was stable, the architects of Bretton Woods and the IMF in particular also wanted an order that was centered on the US Treasury rather than Wall Street or the City of London, like in the 1920s or in the 1930s. So in other words, governments should be in the driving seat. And they were particularly concerned about free, unchecked capital flows, because they thought that hot money flows would make it much harder for countries to safeguard stability and prevent crises from financial crisis from arising, or at least dealing with them effectively. And so both major policymakers, Keynes and White, took the view that restrictions on capital flows should become a permanent feature of this international monetary order. And this is what most states maintain for several decades after 1944. So tight controls on capital, so-called capital account transactions. That's to be distinguished from so-called current account transactions. Essentially, payments for goods delivered or services rendered. Those need to be free under the IMF articles back then and today. But IMF member countries back then and today still retain the ability, though they haven't done so much in recent decades, to limit capital account transactions. And this is precisely what the founders of the IMF had in mind. Now, let me come to the third swing of the pendulum. And this came in 1971. In 1971, we have a unilateral decision by the United States to break the convertibility of the dollar into gold. And with that, the international monetary order that had been established after World War II collapsed or was really collapsed by the United States in what came to be known as the Nixon shock of 1971. The dollar had come under sustained pressure due to persistent deficits, trade deficits of the United States. And once this old international monetary order had gone, the world moved over time to a system of national choice of exchange rate arrangement, with the United States and other developed economies initially moving to floating exchange rates, where the value of currencies was determined by supply and demand in foreign exchange markets. And it was really at the time, mid-level US policy maker, Paul Volcker, who later on became a highly regarded, at least in some quarters, a highly regarded chair of the Federal Reserve, who was at that time responsible for monetary affairs in the US Treasury, who took this decision that the US should abandon this link between the dollar and gold. He chaired a working group that prepared, on the one hand, legal studies on the authority of the President of the United States to end this convertible without involving the Congress, and also considered what this meant in terms of the international monetary obligations of the United States. And the working group concluded that ending the convertibility was a clear breach of the obligations of the United States under the IMF Articles of Agreement. It also concluded that there were grounds, as a result of this breach, for the IMF to expel the United States from membership of the IMF, but outsized American influence and the large capital contribution of the United States meant, in all likelihood, that this wouldn't happen in practice. Now, what's interesting is that the IMF was very much a bystander to this crucial decision that fundamentally reshaped the international monetary system. The then managing director of the IMF, Pierre-Paul Schweitzer, that's the most senior IMF official who usually meets with head of governments or at least treasury secretaries, was invited to meet Volcker at 1 hour's notice and informed that the United States was going to take this major step, and then was invited to watch President Nixon's speech announcing the abandonment of the convertibility of the dollar into gold on television. So the IMF was just watching us as this three-decade-old international monetary order effectively collapsed overnight as a result of a decision taken by the US Treasury. So this swing of the pendulum sidelined, and in some ways made the IMF a less important and influential international financial organization. And it was left to the IMF over the coming years to reinvent itself in a world that wasn't in an international monetary order, that was no longer characterized by a fixed exchange rate. And within around 5 years, the IMF lost its central role as the guardian of global financial stability. We have a shift away through an amendment of the IMF Articles of Agreement, through an amendment in particular that was enacted in 1978, away from international monetary law as found in the IMF Articles of Agreement to international financial and a new actor in international finance, the Basel Committee. And with that, we see a gradual shift over a few years from back to what we had in the interwar period, not very successful, of informal cooperation between national policymakers and regulators that wasn't in any significant shape or form constrained by law, either national or international law. This relative weakness of international financial law, it took the form of standards, non-binding principles in part reflected the economic reality that by the 1970s, official sector flows, that is, cross-border capital flows, were dwarfed by private sector capital flows, and that even the most important central banks were no longer had the reserves to be able to intervene in foreign exchange markets on a sustained basis. And with that, the ideal that Keynes and White and others had shared in 1944, that there should be a very important degree of public oversight, that governments should be involved in the management of exchange rates, should be coordinated through the IMF, that idea fell into disuse. And today, of course, this imbalance between official capital flows and private capital flows has only become more unbalanced, and only a handful of central banks could intervene in foreign exchange markets, but they rarely do so. Instead, we have new risks in the financial sector, such as collapses of banks, even of relatively small banks and other financial institutions, and the response to that, to those challenges to financial stability, has often taken the form of self-regulation by the financial industry, or standards that have been developed, non-binding standards that have been developed through the Basel Committee and other standard setters, including later the Financial Stability Board. So this is in keeping with a more general trend that we observe in other areas, of course, of international cooperation as well, towards deformalization and a lesser role for public international law. Think, for example, of the Basel Committee, which has no international legal personality. It's notable for its procedural and legal informality. It develops standards only. These standards are agreed at the international level by national regulators and supervisors. And the idea is that these standards are then implemented in domestic law, again, by those same regulators or supervisors. They lack any formal pedigree under international law, these standards, but this hasn't necessarily meant that these standards have been ineffective, because states have, by and large, implemented, as was the intention, these standards. And this standard setting by the Basel Committee, later joined by other standard setting in this field, first became an issue in 1974, when an unknown German bank, Herstatt Bank, collapsed. It had engaged in massive currency trading in this new world of floating exchange rates. At the time when it was closed by the West German regulator, it had 103 times its foreign exchange exposure was more than 100 times its regulatory capital. So there was serious concern at the time that this unknown, pretty small German bank could endanger international German and also international financial stability. It affected currency markets worldwide. For example, currency trading in the next week following this closure in New York was down by 90%. And it was this that provided the initial impetus for why it was important to have global standards. Basel Committee takes charge of this. It's housed by the Bank for International Settlement, which is a treaty-based international organization that was initially set up to administer German reparations under the SI. And the Basel Committee has, since its inception, come up with three iterations of the Basel Capital Accord, which are standards about how much capital banks need to hold to back up their lending. Now, there are all sorts of concerns about whether these capital adequacy standards have how well they have fulfilled their function of preserving financial stability. There are studies that suggest that their contribution to financial stability has been modest. There have also been concerns that these standards tend to come after the fact. So we need to have a financial crisis. Think about the Latin American debt crisis in the 1980s. And then these new risks to financial stability end up years later being reflected in the Basel Capital Accords and elsewhere in international financial standard setting. And the same thing again with the global financial crisis. Now, more than a decade after the globe, 15 years after the global financial crisis, we're finally moving close to the national implementation of the third iteration of the Basel Capital Accord. So it does tend to take quite a long time for these standards to be implemented in national law, sometimes because there is considerable resistance from the financial services sector against their implementation. Now, as I've suggested, the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, moving back to international monetary law, in the early 1970s, is a striking example of how multilateralism based on these IMF articles of agreement, treaty obligations in monetary matters, how those were virtually disappeared overnight. And we moved from multilateralism to minilateralism, where other actors, particularly the Basel Committee and later the Financial Stability Board, became central actors. And lawyers at the IMF and elsewhere could only recognize after the fact, ratify this new reality, in particular, the unilateral decision of the United States to end the convertibility of the dollar into gold. We still have some international monetary obligations in the IMF articles of agreement. But if we look, for example, at Article 4, which is a key article in the IMF articles of agreement, we now read there that IMF member states, and that's virtually all states in the world, can choose their own exchange rate arrangements. That's the key change from the Bretton Woods system until 1971, away from the PAR system, to you choose whether your currency is floating, whether it is pegged, as Argentina has, for example, done for a number of years in the lead up to its financial crisis in 2001. So national choice, what the exchange rate should look like, and this is subject to what is called IMF surveillance. So the IMF used to be, and that's why it was a very important and influential international organization, a coordinator and at least potential enforcer of international monetary obligations relating to the PAR system. With this shift to national choice, it became essentially a surveillance organization that engages in regular dialogue with national policymakers, that issues reports, and this is where there is an asymmetry. It has an important role in countries, has a much more influential role in countries to which it lends. That gives the IMF a lot of leverage. It can demand policy changes in return for the financing that it provides. But by and large, the IMF hasn't lent to large economies, particularly developed economies, in the last 5 decades. And in those countries, the IMF has had much more limited leverage. And so it's essentially just engaged in regular dialogue with the authorities, sharing its views with these authorities, while the key decisions are taken in the countries concerned. So in all those countries where that do not require IMF resources, France, the United Kingdom in the last 5 decades, the United States, Japan, and so on, there aren't in practice any, there are very limited meaningful monetary rules that apply. And even those rules that do apply, the IMF hasn't in practice managed to apply or to enforce them. We can see that, for example, we find some limited obligation in the IMF articles as revised in 1978 with respect to the potential manipulation by an IMF member state of its exchange rate. We find an obligation that an IMF member state shall avoid manipulating exchange rates in order to gain an unfair competitive advantage over other member states. But in practice, this has proven to be an extremely high threshold because it requires both an objective showing that there has been a manipulation of an exchange rate and an intent by the state concerned to gain an unfair competitive advantage. And even though, for example, the United States has alleged for years that China has engaged in such currency manipulation practices, or even Switzerland, we have findings by the US Treasury to that effect, or Brazil or other countries, all attempts to address this through the IMF Articles of Agreement did not go anywhere. Now, I have suggested that we have seen a pendulum swing in international monetary law from initially a system of informal monetary cooperation after the disastrous experience of the interwar period for 3 decades to a system of pegged exchange rate. And then the pendulum has swung again towards informality in the form of standard setting in international financial law. Throughout this whole period, we also have a constant, and that is we've never had serious attempts to institute a system of dispute settlement, voluntary or compulsory, in this area of international monetary cooperation. There has always been an emphasis on consultations, certainly since the IMF has been set up, between the IMF as an international organization and its members. The IMF provides its expertise, and the IMF is influential where it lends. Beyond that, the IMF's influence is limited. A lot depends on consultation. So international monetary law, and that's perhaps not untypical in international law, has ebbed and flowed over time. There isn't a march of inevitable progress, more rules or harder rules, but it tends to reflect how international monetary is configured at any particular point in time, market developments, and a political economy. Initially, we have this rise of the international monetary order for the first quarter century or so after World War II, that collapses in the Nixon shock, and now we don't have a significant role for the IMF in the oversight, certainly, of exchange rates. The emphasis, focus of activity has shifted from Washington, where the IMF is headquartered, to Basel, both before and after the global financial crisis. Now, this doesn't mean that the IMF hasn't evolved in at least some way. It has always provided from the beginning data on macroeconomic indicators and independent analysis. And that is a useful function. But there is little doubt that the IMF today, or 20 years ago, was a less powerful international and less influential international organization than it was in, say, 1960 or 1970. And given the size of cross-border private cross-border capital flows, there are also serious questions about whether the IMF is up to this task, because the IMF has resources available to it up to close to $1 trillion US dollars. But that is just 1% of world GDP, and it's 4% of US GDP. So that is enough to deal with several small crises, at any given time, but not enough for more than one big crisis. And of course, what we have also seen in the last 1.5 decades play out is geopolitical rivalries, as in many other international organizations in the IMF. The IMF is traditionally an organization that has been deeply influenced both in its design and its practical operation by major Euro-Atlantic states, particularly the United States and the United Kingdom. The United States still retains de facto veto power over IMF decisions, or important IMF decisions, and attempts to rebalance voting rights in the IMF towards countries, developing countries and countries whose share of world economic output has grown more rapidly than of Euro-Atlantic states, have only been very gradual and haven't, for example, reflected the economic weight of China, India, Brazil, Indonesia, and others. But if in an age of US-Chinese geopolitical rivalry, international cooperation isn't possible in international monetary affairs, which isn't a particularly political, or one should think, particularly controversial area for international cooperation, then it might suggest that the future for international law and international organizations in other areas might not be particularly optimistic. Now, one conclusion one might draw from this is that one shouldn't attempt to introduce any new international monetary obligations, and that the best approach is to continue on the present path of focusing energies on standard setting in international financial law. But as the interwar, the experience in the interwar period suggests, currency instability, capital controls that proliferated, and so on, the fragmentation of the payment system, there are serious limits to this soft law approach. The IMF can, of course, provide expertise, some financial resources, coordination, and a forum for dialogue between central banks and treasury departments. But there are question marks about whether that is enough to deal with major challenges, such as global imbalances between debtor and creditor countries. That was already a key concern in 1944. At the same time, the IMF has shown that, at least in some cases, that it is able to innovate within its current constraints, those found in the IMF Articles of Agreement, and more generally in its institutional system. It has provided very rapid financing to Ukraine after Ukraine was attacked by the Russian Federation. And the IMF is currently in the process of providing rapid financing to countries in the Middle East that are deeply affected by the war in Gaza. Thank you very much for your attention. I look forward to the discussion and your questions.